welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories of a beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 a.m. It's Tuesday. That means 2 for Tuesday. You've been 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. It's one artist, two songs. You program it. 312-981-7200. Alrighty then, it is time for our monthly visit with Tom Appel. He is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, and you can follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. And he joins us every month to talk about all automotive stories and issues, and car issues and cars and all that stuff. And if you have any questions, he can help you out at 312-981-7200 for Talk and Text. Let's welcome Tom back to the show. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure. All right, you know, let's do the general for the people who may be new to the segment. We've been doing it for a long time, but tell them all about Consumer Guide Automotive and stuff.
Yeah, consumerguide.com. That's where we keep all of our new car and used car reviews. We've been around since 1967. If you're not looking for a car right now, just skip ahead to our blog. There's a link right there at consumerguide.com, or you can go straight to it, cgdailydrive.com blog. We try to have some fun with car culture. We go in-depth on some car reviews, and we look back at old advertising, all sorts of stuff.
I have to say that this is I was looking at the Automotive Liars Club.
Yes.
The three BS artists I've endured. And we got to get to that a little bit later on.
Yeah, that was cathartic to write.
I bet it was. I bet it was. It's also really, really funny. And
good.
So we'll get to that a little bit later on. That's part of the blog. So I always ask you, you know, right out of the gate, what have you guys been driving? What have you been driving lately?
I'm driving the 2019 Honda Ridgeline. And this is one of the most underappreciated vehicles in America right now. Mm. This is Honda's compact pickup truck. It is not quite as heavy duty as some of the other compact pickup trucks out there, but it is a whole lot nicer than most of them. Really nice interior, rides well, useful pickup bed. And I think most people don't need more truck than this. It's mid-size, it works really well, and it's just not selling, which is strange because it's really very good.
Oh, okay. And it's driving okay then? You like it?
Oh, yeah, I like it a lot.
Okay. And what else have you driven recently since the last time we talked?
Oh, wow, what did I just drive recently? I just drove the Nissan Altima SL all-wheel drive. So new for 2019, Nissan has made the Altima all-wheel drive. That's their midsize sedan. And it's an interesting move because, as everyone knows, sedan sales are in steep decline because everyone's moving to crossovers. So one of the big differentiators here for Nissan is all-wheel drive. Nice car, and I got really good mileage considering it was all-wheel drive, almost 30 miles per gallon.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, that's really cool. What else has been going around the office? What are other people driving around the office that they are enjoying?
We just got a very, I hesitate to call it silly, but a seriously off-road version of another compact pickup. This is the Chevy Colorado, ZR2 Bison. And this has been upfitted for serious off-road use. The version we have has the diesel engine as well. But we're actually rather enjoying it, and we wish we had some reason to go off-road.
Yeah.
It's a little over the top, but there is a market for it, and it's very well executed.
Really? What do you mean by over the top?
It's lifted. It's considerably lifted. You can see a lot of the parts. This is exactly the way someone might do this job at home if they had a lot of time and a lot of money. So that the pieces that you can see that help lift the vehicle and make it off-road ready are really nicely finished. So it presents very well from any angle.
That's hilarious. That's great. Bison, huh?
Bison. Yep.
Yeah. Do you ever ask how they come up with the names for these cars? Have you ever done a piece on that over the years, Tom?
We've done a couple of worst model names over the years, but we've never actually asked the question why.
Yeah.
which is a great question.
It is. I mean, it's got to be by, you know, there has to be like a room full of people, right? I mean, it's like maybe taking a vote. Oh, yeah, Bison sounds like a good name for a car.
And you would think these are huge corporations, so you would think that there was all sorts of clinics and focus groups to get these names, but who knows?
Who knows is right. But some of the classic car names, you know, we've talked about this many times in the past, Tom. Do you have a favorite car name from the past?
Favorite car name. I've always liked the name Firebird. I like all the Firebird names. So I like Thunderbird, I like Firebird, I like Phoenix.
Yeah.
I think those are great names.
Yeah, absolutely. God. All right, we got here a quick question here before we break for the news, and we got to talk about the strike. That's a big story,
yes.
Tom. So we're definitely going to get to that. But let's see. Taxi driver Bob is here. Bob, go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
All right.
I was wondering if Mr. LaPelle had driven a Alfa Romeo Giulia and then the top-of-the-line one with a Quadra, whatever it is, the one with the shamrock on it, the four-leaf clover shamrock on it.
Yeah, the Quadra Foglio.
Yeah, Foglio, right.
Here's the thing. I'm a huge guy. I don't really fit in that car very well. But that said, it is a hoot to drive. It's something like 505 horsepower.
Oh, my
this
God.
This is Alfa Romeo's compact car. Quadra Foglio is the top trim level. And it's a twin turbo. And I want to say it's a 2.9-liter V6. It might be a 3-liter V6. But it is really high strung. It is a joy to drive. It's really loud. I don't know that it's a practical daily driver. But it does scream.
Is it one of those cars that costs like $150 to do an oil change or something like that?
The maintenance could be expensive. I don't know. That's a great question. You should bring it back to the Alfa dealer for service, and that could get expensive.
Yeah. All right, Bob, thanks.
I'm sure. Thanks.
All right, buddy, take care. Do you think that taxi driver Bob is his taxi is an Alfa Romeo, maybe?
I hope so. I doubt it.
What's the, when you drive one of these crazy cars, I mean, because that's crazy.
It is crazy.
How do you have to change your mindset as to, you know, because you want to, for those kind of cars, for the cars that people, you know, consumer guide automotive, a lot of it is practical stuff that people are concerned about. That's the kind of stuff you look out for. That's the kind of stuff that you report on. Now, you got to change your mindset when you get into something crazy like an Alfa Romeo, right?
Well, you absolutely do, because Alfa doesn't really address the needs of most buyers.
Right.
It's a very sporty thing. It's a very particular thing. And no, you're making an excellent point, Nick, because when you get into it, you just have to hope that it does what it's supposed to do well. And in this case, that car does do that. It's a little cramped. It's a little bit expensive, but it is a hoot to drive. And if you had that kind of money, for a third car, because you really, I don't know if you want to commute in that, why not?
I could just see, you know, parking in the company parking lot with that thing, you know, and leaving it there all day while you're at your desk. You know, it just seems it's crazy to me.
I remember an executive at a company I worked at purchased a Maserati Quattroporte at a very conservative company. It was all anyone talked about until the guy was eventually fired.
Yeah. Well, I can understand that. Why would you show up in such a conspicuous car?
I don't know. It was a weird thing. At the company I was at the time, it was an extremely bizarre choice.
Yeah.
Because the owner himself was not driving an especially ostentatious car.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just a very strange decision.
Oh, so it was just some dude was trying to outdo the boss?
I don't know. Maybe. Yes. It was weird. It was ill-considered.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow, that's just really crazy. All right. Tom, hang on, okay?
Will do.
All right, Tom Appel is here. He joins us once a month. He is a publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, which is a great website. Check out consumerguide.com. Follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. We're going to talk about this strike that's happening right now. The United Auto Workers Union is on strike, and we'll tell you about that. And he'll answer any and all of your car-related questions. So if you're in the market for a car of some kind, or you have a car or automotive-related question of any kind, text or call us at 312-981-7200. We'll get back to all the car talk right after we break for the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Good morning. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline Studios. We are here till 5 a.m. as we are every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And here live and local, it is Nick DiGilio. And we're talking about Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. You can follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. And he is here to talk about automotive stories in the news and to answer any and all of your questions and concerns about cars and so forth. 312-981-7200. All right, let's get back to it. And here is Tom. Hey, Tom.
Hey.
All right, let's talk about this strike. And how it's going to affect General Motors in many ways. So first of all, how did the strike start? The United Auto Workers Union, about 48,000 members are striking. How did this happen, and what are the effects going to be in long term?
This strike is was fairly predictable from the start because this was the UAW negotiating a new contract with the big three automakers. So the UAW, when a contract is coming due, generally picks one manufacturer, and that would be Ford or General Motors, or now it's FCA, used to be the Chrysler Corporation, and they strike against them to negotiate the best deal possible. And then that deal is usually the one that's used as a framework for dealing with the other two manufacturers.
Got it.
So that's fairly typical that be on strike. This strike's a little bit long already at 2 weeks. And what's different now than things had been even in the recent past is that domestic manufacturers have adopted something fairly common in Asian manufacturers, which is just-in-time systems and delivery, which means they don't maintain the kind of inventory they used to. Now, I'm talking about parts more than vehicles, but there are already shops, dealerships, and parts warehouses that are running dry of certain parts. So this is a problem. And in fact, this is just personal observation. I was talking to a guy tonight at the health club whose daughter's car cannot be fixed for emissions problems. So the car is actually going to be grounded for a little while until they can get some parts.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so this is a real life, it's happening now to people kind of thing.
And what are the other impacts that it's going to have on GM?
Well, it remains to be seen. General Motors did something called a build-out, so they knew the strike was coming, so they built an awful lot of vehicles to pad inventory. So as yet, 2 weeks into the strike, most dealerships have enough vehicles for now. But what happens is as the inventory goes down, people aren't finding the kind of vehicles that they want, the color, the trim level, whatever. So it kind of gets harder to sell the remaining inventory. So we'll see what happens there. Hopefully this thing's going to wrap up in a week or two.
And what is it that specifically that the UAW wants?
One of the things they want, there's two particular factories that they're talking about. General Motors wanted to close these factories, and the UAW wants them to keep them open. One of them was Lordstown, and that's probably not going to stay open. That's where General Motors used to build the Cruze, the Chevrolet Cruze. The other one is Hamtramck, which is in Detroit, and that plant's been around for a long time. General Motors is talking about building an electric pickup truck there, probably an electric version of the Silverado, and the UAW would very much like General Motors to do that. One of the things about that, though, is even if General Motors could be pressured into keeping that plant open, it would probably not employ that many people, because even an electric version of something as popular of the Silverado is probably not going to be very high volume. Maybe we're looking at 30, 40, 50,000 units. It's not what a factory generally cranks out.
And so, in that regard, would that be the only thing that they would be working on in that plant, the plant that you're talking about that might be closing?
That's a great question, because Hamtramck has traditionally built multiple things at one time, but it's kind of been kind of a studio or a boutique place where they built a lot of low-volume things. So I don't know the answer to that. They could put other low-volume stuff there, potentially, but right now the plant isn't earmarked for anything.
And so what does it look like is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen, though?
I think that the Lordstown plant, which they may have a buyer for, and that's a whole different story, is probably going to be underutilized by another manufacturer, and I don't think that there's anything the UAW can do about that. Hamtramck will probably remain open just because it's really convenient. It's in Detroit, and if, in fact, Chevy is going to build this electric pickup truck there, that's probably a good place for them to do it. And if that plant's open, they'll probably find a way to utilize other parts of the plant over time.
And let me ask you this. As the years have gone by and the technology has changed and upped so hugely in the world of car manufacturing and all that, how has that affected the relationship between the companies and the union?
Oh, it's been bad. I mean, we go back to Michael Moore's film, Roger and Me.
Yeah.
Right at the time when General Motors
that was 30 years ago, too.
Yeah, that was a while ago. And that's about the time that General Motors started to discover robotics. And they were looking for ways to lower to reduce the headcount in its workforce. And, of course, the UAW wanted to protect jobs. And there's all sorts of different job clarifications and all sorts of different reasons why the General Motors couldn't lay these people off. And I think that's where the tension sort of began. And we've seen that ever since then. And there's probably more UAW workers than General Motors needs, but that's the way these contracts work.
And at the bottom line, how is this going to hit GM financially?
It could hurt them pretty hard. There's a couple of launches right now. Chevrolet had redesigned the Silverado about a year ago, and it never really caught fire like it should have. And they were busy ramping up versions of the vehicle that had not initially been available. So this is messing with that. Plus, and this is probably more psychological than it is actually fiscal, but the new Corvette is due out right now. And this is stalling that, which is kind of a headache, too.
Are people looking forward to the new Corvette?
Oh, yeah. The demand is huge. Apparently, it's sold out for the first year.
Wow.
Yeah, this is probably the most excitement there's been around a new Corvette in a long time.
And so wow, and there could be a delay. I wonder, that's got to be frustrating, right?
Yeah, it is. It's really going to frustrate dealers who probably have deposits down on these vehicles.
Oh, man. All right, well, so this is widespread, then. It's going to affect a lot of people.
It is, yeah, and the people that, it's funny because we think about the UAW workers being affected, and they are because they're not making full salaries right now, but it's the Tier 2 and Tier 3 suppliers to General Motors that have been idled, and those workers aren't being paid at all, nor are they going to expect any sort of improvement in pay or salary as a result of this, and they're really being hurt.
How often have strikes happened in the past?
I'm trying to think of how many times there's been a contract renewal without a strike.
Mm.
And it's happened, but I think the strike is more common than not.
Yeah, that's what it seems like to me. You know, as somebody who just has kind of a cursory knowledge of what's going on there, but it seems like I hear the word strike a lot in the world of car manufacturing.
Yeah, it just seems like that's just a regular part of the negotiations now.
Yeah. How different is Detroit now as it used to be? I mean, you know, all of these years of financial problems and the technology that's changing everything. What's the city of Detroit? How much of a hit have they taken?
The city itself?
Yeah.
I don't know. Everyone talks about Detroit 2.0. That's the thing. If you go to Detroit, that's what you hear.
Yeah.
Detroit 2.0. And there is sort of a renaissance. There's a couple of companies that have moved back in there. And one of the things that's kind of helped in Detroit is that Chinese manufacturers that are looking to get a foot into being suppliers to the auto industry are setting up shop there.
Oh, okay.
So that's good.
Yeah.
They're building in the U.S. So there is some comeback. It seems slower. If you talk to people who live in Detroit or monitor the industry near Detroit, they're not as optimistic maybe as the city itself is.
Yeah.
But it seems to be getting better slowly.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. We'll keep an eye on everything that's happening there. We got some texts that have come in, Tom.
Okay.
608 area code says, what do you think of the Mazda Miata RF?
Oh, I wish I fit better in a Miata because the Miata is pure joy.
Yeah.
It was redesigned like 2 years ago, and it's awesome. The RF is the retractable hardtop version of the car. It weighs about 150 pounds more than the regular Miata, but you don't feel the weight. It's still absolutely a joy to drive.
Okay.
And what's nice is that you have, you know, winter security. It seals up nicely. It's sort of a coupe and a convertible.
Okay. All right. 815 area code says, you're talking about all the light pickup trucks. What's the best diesel pickup?
In the light pickups, and if he means by that half ton, what's kind of interesting and kind of exciting, for the first time, I think, in pickup truck history for 2020, all three manufacturers will have a light-duty diesel. They're all 3-liter turbo diesels, and there will be one in the F-150 and the Silverado and the Ram and the GMC Sierra. As for which one is best, that's hard to say. I haven't driven all three of them yet. I haven't driven the Ford or the Chevy. Ram is claiming the most towing capacity. Chevy is claiming the best mileage. And I think the Fords might be the easiest one to get into financially.
Okay.
So picking one, I can't do.
Okay, gotcha. Well, those are your options right there.
Yeah.
All right, okay. So Fiat Chrysler. They were kind of lying a little bit about their sales numbers. What's going on? And now they're getting hit with a $40 million fine? Tell me about that.
Yeah, this was awesome because it seemed like every single month when the sales reports were coming out, and it happens like today, the first day of the month, the sales reports would come out, and there was a period of time where every single month Chrysler would announce that it had broken a new monthly record. And we'd all be scratching our heads like, wow, that's incredible. And part of what was going on that made it kind of believable is that Jeep was just blazing hot.
Yeah.
That Jeep had added a bunch of light-duty models, you know, the Cherokee and the other Renegade, and these were selling well. So it seemed credible on some level that they could do this, but apparently they weren't doing it.
And that's not a good thing. So they're getting slapped with a fine.
Yeah, the fine is interesting because the reason for it was not that so much that they were lying or advertising, but it was that they were misleading investors, which
yeah.
is a very interesting thing, and yeah, that is a problem. So they're slapped with a $40 million fine, which in the world of automotive industry is probably not a huge amount of money, but it's a pretty big fine.
Yeah, now, and does this happen? Does this happen? Who watches over this? The sales numbers. Who governs this and makes sure, you know, watchdogs?
I don't know, because in this time, I think it was the Securities Exchange Commission that came down on them.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the authority that would usually monitor this. It's interesting, too, because there are so many media outlets that monitor sales.
Yeah.
That it's surprising that it got this far.
Is that a common practice for companies to overstate their sales?
I don't think so. You can inflate them towards the end of the year by pushing some stuff from inventory into dealer lots.
Oh, okay.
And that's not uncommon. And what you'll see, too, towards the end of the year, there's a couple of sales races. Mercedes-Benz, BMW, and Lexus. Really, Mercedes-Benz and BMW always have this race to see who's the best-selling luxury car manufacturer in the U.S. And they do things like crazy leases towards the end of the year. And I'm sure that they just move some things out of inventory onto dealer lots if they can. And that's reasonably within the realm of...
Uh-huh.
Because they're not fabricating sales. They're just kind of pulling them ahead.
Okay, well, so that's a little bit more acceptable.
A little bit.
Okay. All right. That's still shady. Okay, Tom, hang on.
Will do.
Tom Appel is with us. He is a publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. He joins us every month to talk about automotive-related questions and concerns and news. If you guys have a question or a comment, if you're in the mood for or if you're in the market for a car, 312-981-7200. And we'll be back more with Tom after this on 720 WGN. My little news group, you don't know what I'm like.
She'll walk a thunderbird like it's standing still. She's boarding and her lead, and she's stroking board. She'll do 140 in the top end floor. She's my little new scoop. You don't know what I got.
All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline studio here, and here until 5 a.m. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some really hilarious knockoff brands. You know, there are your regular brands, and then just, you know, some crazy knockoffs. Some of them are generic in stores all over the place, and some of them are from other countries, like Robert Cop, the action figure, instead of RoboCop. So we're also going to talk about terrible roles that actors took for the money and the most paused movie scenes. That's coming up as we continue on the show. But right now, Tom Appel is with us, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Tom Appel from Consumer Guide Automotive is with us, and we're talking about cars and automotive stuff, and let's welcome Tom back. Tom, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, got a couple of texts here.
Okay.
847 area code says, EVs are supposed to help lessen the dependency for gasoline, which helps the environment, but does the process of manufacturing EV batteries or disposables of those batteries harm the environment? That's a great question.
It's a great question, and I think the answer is a little bit unclear, although I think it is understood that the manufacturing of an EV versus that of an internal combustion engine regular vehicle, conventional vehicle, is probably just a little bit more carbon intensive, which is offset in operation, presumably, hopefully, by the electric operation. However, the disposal of the battery is still a really open-ended question. There haven't been that many electric vehicles that have been demolished as yet or taken apart, so there aren't that many batteries laying around yet. And there are all these very grand plans to use these batteries that still have some life in stationary power storage facilities. But as yet, this hasn't really begun to happen. And then the larger question is, what happens to those batteries when they're not good for that?
Oh, yeah.
So at some point, they're going to have to be cleaned and reconditioned, but I don't know that system's quite in place yet.
Okay. So the questions are still up in the air then?
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about these driverless shuttles that may be the future of our work commute. I don't want driverless to be the future of my work commute. We've obviously the technology has been going crazy. We've been talking about driverless vehicles for a while, and I think you and I both have the same kind of thought that it's a little bit freaky, to say the least.
It is a little bit freaky.
Yeah. And what about these shuttles?
Yeah, these shuttles are interesting. A company called Optimus Ride, which was born of a project out of MIT, which is interesting, is building shuttles now. They're six-passenger shuttles that will work on the campuses of larger corporations and, I guess, some colleges at some, in some applications. And there are some of these in use right now. But what's interesting is that they're kind of proof of concept of real proof of concept of real autonomy, and that they're going to work in a geo-fenced area. And you're going to hear this term a lot as we move forward with autonomous vehicles. And a geo-fenced area just means that the area is actually set up with the infrastructure to support the autonomous operation. So there'll be sensors and other things in place that allow the autonomous vehicle to work better than it would just on the open road. And I think that these are limited to 25 miles per hour. They seat six people. There's no gear in there whatsoever to steer or turn or brake the vehicles. They're completely autonomous, and they work in these very controlled environments.
Yeah.
And I think it's really good proof of concept for the project, but I think it also proves how far away true autonomy might be.
Yeah. Okay. All right, that makes sense. And again, you know, we're talking about names. Optimus Ride.
Optimus Ride. That's a good name.
Yeah, it is. It's a great name. You know, it just never stops, man. 847 area code sends a text that says, in the market for a new sedan, which is better of the three, Honda Accord, Toyota Camry, or Nissan Altima?
For 2019, Consumer Guide made both the Camry and the Accord Best Buy picks. So we picked both of those vehicles. Of the two, I like the Camry, but I vastly prefer the Accord.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite cars of all time. It is just a really well-built, balanced car. It is fun to drive in any form, and I really like the Accord Hybrid.
Okay.
It's just a heck of a good car.
Very cool. Thank you for answering that question. Here's a story out of Minnesota, Tom.
Yeah.
They make moves to get more electric vehicles on the roads. Are other states doing this as well?
Yeah, this is an interesting story, and I had to read it a couple of times till I got to what it was really about. But the state of Minnesota, and the governor is driving this, is working to make the state to make in the state more electric vehicle choices, essentially.
Got it.
And they want manufacturers to provide those. And it sounds a little bit like it's kind of a confusing and unenforceable thing. But then if you read further, what they really want to do, it seems, is to join the Green State Coalition. And the Green States are some 13 states that include California, Washington, and Oregon, and a bunch of Northeast states that use California emissions as their standards, the California emission standards. And what works here is because of those standards in those states, manufacturers make more electric vehicles available there. So you have vehicles like the Fiat 500e, which is an electric version of the Fiat 500, is only available in some of those green states. So what Minnesota seems to be hoping to do is for manufacturers to bring those vehicles that are only in limited distribution to their state.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. And what was the time frame on this? They said, what, 2023?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. All right. Keep an eye on that. All right. I want to get to, before we got to let you go, let's talk about this Automotive Liars Club. Where did you single out three BS artists that you've endured. Tell me about where this came from and tell me about these three guys.
Yeah, I think everyone knows these guys. If anyone who knows something about something, you know, like I'm a car guy,
yeah,
runs into people that, largely because you're a car guy, want to tell you things about what you know about, and you know they're lying, and it almost hurts. It's almost physical pain. And so there were three of these guys that just stuck out in my mind when I wrote this piece, and one of them was Monte Carlo guy.
Yeah.
And this is a guy in an office I worked at who had a 83 or 84 Monte Carlo, and it was a total wreck. But this guy would saunter up to me every day and be like, yeah, I hit 120 miles an hour on Route 53 today. And it's like, no, dude, you didn't. You just didn't. You know, those things are 300 horsepower from the factory. No.
An 83 Monte Carlo?
Yeah.
It wasn't good. That's hilarious. What about Firebird guy? Because at one point I was a Firebird guy.
Firebird guy was awesome. He was a friend of the mechanic at the gas station I worked at when I was in high school, and he was a really nice guy. He looked a little bit like Tom Petty's underfed brother, and he had this I think it was a 78 Firebird Formula.
Okay.
And he was constantly telling me stories of his plans for this vehicle. And the best part of the story was one day he just pulls into the station, and he's in the office, and I should be working, but I'm talking to this guy. He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
And he's telling me the story about how he's got the engine out of the car right now, and I'm looking out the window, but the car is there. And he realizes what he's done. He's like, well, I've got a different engine in there right now.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. All right. Tom Petty's underfed brother. Yeah, I like that. Okay, and then before we get out of here, tell me about Neon Guy.
Neon Guy was the best. This was actually a horse ranch somewhere near the Wisconsin Dells. I was there with my wife and daughter, and there was something that was like a bar at this place. And the bartender started showing me these pictures that he had taken from high-tension wires. Like, he'd crawled up these things, and he was explaining to me, and he really took the pictures, and they looked real. But he's explaining to me that he was part of some secret civil defense team, and that they had given him a special government chip for his Dodge Neon that made it capable of going 147 miles an hour. Like, what are you talking about? The beauty of it was when my wife and I left this bar, we look outside and we see this neon, and it's just festooned in antennas. I don't know what this guy does, but
wow, that's hilarious.
Oh, it's awesome.
That's hilarious. Well, people can read this at the Consumer Guide Automotive at the blog. Tom, it's always a pleasure, man. Have a great month, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Oh, the pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
Buddy. Tom Appel, man, he's the best. He's the best. As I've said before, this is one of my favorite segments that we do ever, and I haven't driven in like 20 years. I don't currently have a car. So, all right, we're going to break here on WGN.